morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Aaron Feuerstein. He is the former owner of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and there's an incredible story that he has to tell. And we're also going to be speaking to Geshe Latri Nyima Dakpa Rinpoche in just a few minutes. But right now, I would like to welcome Linda Siegel with today's legislative update.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good to have you. So what is happening out in the frigid weather of this state capitol?
Well, of course, yesterday was the last day that bills can be introduced in the 30-day session. That was the midpoint. So there was a flurry of introductions, and we got about 1,200 bills that have been introduced this session. But one of the hot topics is health care, of course.
And what is happening in health care?
Well, yesterday, Governor Richardson, who has a very ambitious health reform bill, brought all the media up and did a press conference and said he's very disappointed because the Health and Government Affairs Committee pretty much gutted his health reform bill and sent it on to House Appropriations. So he's applying the pressure now and trying to get that bill back into play in the way he wants it. And some of the things they took out were a mandate to have insurance and the amount of money that employers would have to put into a fund if they didn't provide insurance for them. And there were some other adjustments to that bill. So it's starting, the pressure is starting, and because there are also other health reform bills. There's the single payer bill, which has been introduced in both the House and the Senate and has actually passed a Senate committee. And then there are sort of attempts at a compromise bill that would just create a health care authority that would continue to work on this issue. So it's very hot right now in the health care arena.
Once a bill is gutted, can guts actually be put back?
Yes, they can. Amendments can be made, and changes that were made in one committee can be reversed in another committee, or even something different can be added on.
And what about the single payer? I mean, polls have shown in New Mexico and elsewhere that a lot of people, if not the majority, perhaps the majority, favor a single payer system. It doesn't get the traction in the legislature that it gets in public, it seems.
Well, and one of the main reasons is what a single payer and the bill that's been the bills that have been introduced this time don't have a period of a year for planning how these things would be implemented. But the problem that many people see with the single payer is that it really takes away all the insurance companies, and the only thing they can sell would be supplemental policies. They would no longer be in the business of selling health insurance.
And which is what a lot of people want. And
yes.
Are they just, I mean, to put it bluntly, are they just making their influence known in various ways in the legislature?
Well, the insurance industry has a number of lobbyists, as you might imagine. But that bill is not dead yet. It's certainly still in play.
Anything else about health care?
Oh, lots of money for health care. One of the big problems is that Medicaid in the House Bill 2, which is passed the House yesterday, is underfunded, and of course that's the program that provides health insurance for low-income people. So it's the next 15 days are going to be pretty exciting.
Is Medicaid purely funded by the state, or is there a federal contribution to Medicaid?
Medicaid in New Mexico is a 3-to-1 match from the feds, so it's a good financial deal for the state. For every dollar we put in, the feds put $3 in.
And yet it's underfunded so that the amount that we need, we would not only shortchange the people who need it, but we wouldn't get those federal dollars?
Yes, that's certainly what many advocates are saying. And, of course, we're in a very tight money year this year. Our revenues have dropped quite a bit compared to last year. So it's hard for the legislature to figure out how to fund everything that needs money.
Well, we will hear about this and much, much more next week. Tuesday and Thursday is the days that Linda Siegels, KSFR's legislative correspondent, joins us. And we'll talk to you then.
Bye, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now, and just stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Geshe Latri Nyima Dakpa Rinpoche. He is a teacher teaching a workshop this Saturday and Sunday, February 2nd and 3rd, from 10 to 4 each day at the Tupton Norbuling Center on East Alameda Street in Santa Fe. We're going to be talking more about that. And I was about to say Buddhist, but it's not a Buddhist tradition. It's the Bön tradition, which is a pre-Buddhist tradition, and I think the original spiritual tradition of Tibet.
Yes, correct. It is a native religion of Tibet, and originally it is being born in Shangchung and the Tibet itself.
And what is the nature of this practice? How is it similar to Buddhism and how is it different?
Well, in many aspects, it really doesn't contradict with the Buddhist philosophy and a Buddhist view of practice, because we all are based on non-violent, of course, and loving and compassion in order to grow your inner quality and to be a good human being, and mainly focus on the compassion and loving. All those very basic ground practices are very much same, not only with the Buddhist and the Bön, but almost most of the religious. Their basic ground is very much based on that. The differences is mainly a history, and the teacher, the founder of both Buddhas are, namely and historically, it is different. As you know, the Buddhist is the Buddha Shakyamuni, who was born in India originally and now is part of Nepal. Likewise, the Buddha Thoma Sherab, who is a founder teacher of Bön, is born in Olmo Lungring and in Shangchung, is not in India. So that kind of, because of that and the continuing of the lineage, the teaching is being passed to Shangchung's masters and then to Tibetan. So the lineage is quite different. And beside the Nyingma, the oldest tradition of the Buddhist, so the Bön has a special teaching, and the highest teaching is known as Dzogchen. So this is not common to all other rest of the Buddhist Dzogchen. They do have a highest teachings, and of course, but by name of Dzogchen, which is only Bön and Nyingma, the oldest tradition have. So the rest is kind of like a practices. Those are kind of differences, we can say.
So what are the goals when somebody is learning the Bön practice? What are their goals? Enlightenment? I mean,
yes, we can always think about the two goals, like we can say relative goal or to achieve, and ultimate accomplishment of the practice in the Bön tradition. Relative is to make your life, this very everyday life, make more peaceful, more happier, more deeper understanding, and so that your practice, that your spirituality can apply in everyday life, so that we are facing all sort of struggles and challenges in a day, so that through the Bön teaching, it could help you to get over and appeasing yourself innerly, and inner peace and calm and compassion, more open and flexibility and so forth. So these are basic everyday needs that how you come overcome to make you more practical ground on the earth with the practice, so that it's not something very all the dogmatic and the fantasies that you are talking about. It's more Bön is really based on the ground that in our everyday life. And that is a relative, what you call, the goals to achieve of the practice to benefit very current level. The ultimate goal is to, of course, to free you from and all sentient beings from the suffering and cutting off the cyclical existence sufferings, so achieve the final enlightenment, state of enlightenment, which is totally free you from all sufferings and that enlightened so-called Buddha, you know. So that is our ultimate goal of the practice.
I have a question about that. It's something that we hear, freedom from suffering for all sentient beings. Does that mean that that life on earth ceases to exist?
Well, meant to be, but as long as the sentient being is continuing, the suffering is always there, because we are not born with the fully enlightened. So that means we're born with ignorance. When we have the ignorance, that is the main sources of all struggle and the problem and misunderstanding and suffering so forth. So according to Burn, the ignorance, which is the root of all sufferings. So as long as that is existing, so everything is not going to cease, all the sufferings.
In other words, if all suffering ceases, there's no more life. In other words, life has suffering in it, and if there's no more suffering, there's no more life.
No, I don't think that. It's a different way of life, I would say. Like, if it's totally day, it's break up and sun arise. So it's a different way of life we are now living in. When we are sleeping and the sun sets, we still are in the life, but in a different life that is more we call a darker or deep sleeping, right? So this in the life, in a practical life, there's a two kind of phases. One is more the light or enlightened one, and one is more like emotions and so on and so forth of in everyday struggle. So both are life, part of life, but this one makes a difference as to how you perceive and how you handle, how you integrate this practice in everyday life. That makes your life more easier or difficult.
I guess what I was wondering is, so if we truly become enlightened through doing the practice, can we still have societies and
enlightened society?
Enlightened society.
In a practice also we say the enlightened one, the we call now in Sanskrit it's called a Buddha, right? Buddha, the Dharma, which is the enlightened teaching, and then the Sangha. Sangha means it's kind of like a community, spiritual community. It's not only a spiritual community, group of the people who are interested or who are practicing. This group, that at a very practical level, what we are talking about, Sangha, or spiritual Sangha, is a kind of representing that quality that we, through the, all the highly realized spiritual community, commune, that who's always concerned and a vision is always a compassion and love to all sentient beings. So we will have a higher and a more pure level of sanghas or the societies.
So what are in the Burn religion, I know in Tibetan Buddhism there are many deities. Are there also in the Burn?
Yes, there are a deity in a general category we can say a peaceful deity and a forceful or wrathful deities. And there are different numbers according to the different teaching connections. You know, normally we say 45 peaceful deities and 82 wrathful deities. And then there is also a protectors, like a peaceful deity, also like a loving mother. You know, we call it Chama, Imjen Sherab Chama, who is a mother of all enlightened Buddhas and sources of love and compassion and wisdom. So in the Buddhist, they have Tara. You know, it's a name differences. I think its essence is very much the same.
What is a deity?
Well, in Tibetan word, when we say deity, it is mean a yidam. It's that something you always connect as your heart and mentally, that you are connected with the practice, that being presence of that, you know, visually, that depends on the teachings, traditions. So if we talk about according to Tantra, then it's more visualizing and transforming yourself, transforming your inner energies, the emotional energies, transform into the more wisdom and a more pure and a more enlightened state of that. So you transform it. So that deity is kind of transforming the full quality of their wisdom, energy, and manifestation aspect. So that is always holded in you as a practice. So that is what we call a yidam. That means holding in the mind as a practice, who protect you, who bless you, who transform you, who ultimately you became that transformation, state of that yidam.
Are the deities real, or are they psychological projections of human beings?
No, it is not exactly that way, because a deity, in a figure level, everybody sees like it's very solid and a form that, you know, when we have a painting of those deity images, thangas, statues, seems like real and solid. But in real, those all are really not an object and solid form, but rather it's a ultimate pure quality of your in and true origin of your potential. When you apply the practice and a focus and a practice, that is how we say totally enlightenment. That means totally free from the ignorance and the suffering cause. So when you are totally free from that, so actually those, whichever the practice, for example, if you are truly practicing and kind of engaging on loving mother, and she's a peaceful deity. So when you practice that, and you really can transform, you really can be in that in a quality level. So there is a more, it's like a body of light. You see, it's not a solid object. That is, object is to yourself to visualize, yourself to connect. But internally, connection is not the object, the essence and the purity of that. So it's more like a body of light, ultimate state of all we human beings.
We're talking to Geshe Latri Nyima Dakpa Rinpoche, who will be teaching this Saturday and Sunday, the 2nd and 3rd of February, from 10 to 4 at the Thubten Norbu Ling Center in Santa Fe on 149 East Alameda. We'll have more information about that in just a little while. So getting back to the Burn religion, is it a religion? Is it something where you have to believe in something, have faith in something? Is it a practice? What is it?
Yeah, if you know, in a sense, like a native religion of Tibet, it's kind of like a name as a religion. Yes, we can consider it as, you know, in Tibet we have five major religions. So Burn is a native and oldest, as His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, during his visit in 2007 in April, and also long before, he have recognized as one of the eldest and earliest native tradition of Tibet and a religion of Tibet. The Burn is actually, it is not only a religion, it's part of life of Tibetan history and Tibetan culture and tradition. And within that potential, it is more, when you apply it, more became a spiritual rather than a religion, I guess. In order to be a benefit and a practice, and benefit that practice in your everyday life, you really don't have to be a religious believer or follower. Rather, you believe or you benefit the spirituality and quality of spiritual aspect.
Is there a God, like a creator God, the way we have in Christianity?
No, we have a lot of gods that we talk about in English translation. I would say the same word, the gods. You know, we have peaceful and doubtful, when we talk about deity and those.
Yeah.
But we don't kind of look or visions. It's a creator. More it is a potential of your individual.
So when you, for example, have people to your workshop on the weekend, on Saturday and Sunday, what do they learn?
Well, in this particular weekend, I'm focusing it to teach and to people to guide how to discover your true inner kind of calm and abiding, the inner peace, and how to meditate. Because everybody have a great interest of meditation, but it's not that everyone is familiar and know about what meditation is and how you meditate it. Important is, you know, when you are applying your time and energy for meditation, and if you are not able to meditate properly, then you don't experience and discover the true ultimate state of meditation. So I'm mostly guiding this time, we call it Shinye, which is teaching you how to concentrate and how to concentrate your focus and make stable and make, and then the how to discover that by practice of this method, you know, and the meditation way, and introducing the what are the struggles that you face in your meditation and how you overcome from that, how to apply the true discovery of true inner peace and understanding of inner happiness by this meditation technique, and then more farther to reach your state of ultimate practice result.
What are some of the struggles that people face in their meditation, and how do they overcome them?
Well, the main obstacle in meditation is like a wilderness, agitations, and then dullness, and weakness of the strength of clarity. So people are not able to understand all this. And when you become the yourself and prepared to meditate, the moment you begin to, you know, kind of begin to reflect all sort of those spontaneous arising thoughts within. And many people chasing after this, and they spend almost their time is chasing after that, and then you say, okay, I finished my meditation session. Or many people have a problem and lack of realizing and understanding in the state of meditation. They are not really meditating, but they are more in inner dullness, in unclarity there. Then there's no any potential result of your meditation may grant. So these things need to be introduced and need to be guided, how to discover that. So how to apply those different methods in order to overcome that. And how to learn yourself, controlling your concentration so you can spend your meditation, everything, each and every second, it's real meditation. So that has a more potential to lead you to your true origin and discover the your true light inside and happiness.
So there are actually techniques for dealing with an agitated mind?
Yes, there are. There are there are certain way of methods that you do focus through with the support objects. Or there is then gradual. There's a gradual levels are there, different level according to the practitioner's capacity of the improvement and the advancing the quality. So accordingly, we guide them.
So you not only teach meditation, you also run an orphanage and a school for children, for Tibetan children, in India.
Yes, it's called Burn Children's Home. It is located in northern part of India in Himachal area, Dolenji. So I founded that in 1988, and with the blessings of His Holiness Dalai Lama's first visit in Dolenji, and then on, started with 45 children. Now I have 300 children, both boys and girls, and many of them are now already in college and closer to graduation, and then rest of them are continuing it.
Now, do they learn the Burn meditation techniques?
Not particularly in a religious level, but we emphasize them spirituality, because my main aim is not to put them in a religious. My main aim is to support and make them a good human being, and on the basis of a true potential of all human spirituality, and which is not a religion, which is a human quality of all sentient beings.
But I mean, do you teach them, for example, meditation techniques?
Well, depends on, if anyone is particularly interested on that, and then if they are prepared, we may and we will. Otherwise, we don't teach particularly on that technique at this very moment. We lead them to show and examples, being participation in those events and spiritual events, so that they make themselves interest and understand and make with the reason of their own understanding. And then if there any of them are interested in meditation, definitely we will guide them and teach.
How is it different teaching children and teaching adults meditation?
Yeah, I think it's very much depend on how you focused on it, I guess. Because sometimes some children are more intelligent and more sharp awareness and knowledge. It's quite easy them to lead from the very beginning. It's much easier than some elders that who are really not very well doing in understanding of those. But in some sense, as being a mature and elder, they have a little bit more common understanding and basic common senses that also will help them to get more deeper in. So it depends on what aspect we are talking about, easy and difficult.
And what about teaching Tibetans versus teaching Americans?
Well, there is some challenges. One is the culture challenges, because in Tibet we very much grow up in the society and culture of that, on which base then we kind of teach them this technique of meditation or teaching of religious or spiritual, because they are well understood and well received by, they are more receptive, and because of understanding of that basic ground. In the West, that is not exactly. So sometimes that makes a little bit time consumed to make them understand and inspire and understand. Once you understood, and then they are more intelligent and they are more have access to understand and easy to apply it too.
What are some of the things that Americans, because of our cultural difference, don't understand that you need to teach in order to make that basic ground that you build on?
So first of all is they have to believe on this kind of like a visualizations that which they are not familiar with. And they have to also, I think one difficulty is to understand something that we teach them, for example, say, true compassion and unconditional compassion. Do everything, sacrifice if needed for others' benefit. That is very difficult to accept in a right way in a first stage or second stage. And also believing in a trust on the religion, philosophy of that, what we teach in. And certain visualization techniques. These are really very difficult because they are more objective and materialist. So they want to have something that they can see, they can feel, that they can connect. then they can say, okay, focus on that. And then that part is a little bit difficult to make them understand. Once they understood, and they are more actually easy to enter into than some of our own Tibetans, because we are more belief, just on a belief, than a kind of study or knowledge level. And in here, it's more begin with study and with the knowledge, and then maybe you will say, okay, I believe on it. I have a faith on it. I have a trust on it. So this, how you enter, is maybe a little bit too different.
So you will be teaching this weekend. Is it for people who already know something about meditation, or is it also for beginners?
I think it's for the beginners also, because as I say, I'm more focusing about how to meditate. What is meditation? And how you achieve that state of meditation in a certain way, and how the struggles arise and how you handle it. So this is really doesn't necessarily that have to be a long time already received or familiar with the teaching, that anyone is new and have interest of meditation and to be focused to experience your own self and inner peace and happiness and understanding true self nature and true self, who we are and how we are. So this is applicable for all, and of course the who are long-time practitioners and believers. Also, it's very important as a refresh, and also there's a lot of clarification and understanding that need to be developed.
Now, how did you become a monk and a teacher? What was your own path?
Well, I belong to the family that is called a spiritual lineage, we call, and a Lati, which is in my name, that is our lineage and ancestors. So because of being that, by kind of family way, I born with a lineage and a responsible as a master. But that doesn't mean that you are qualified to teach and be a teacher professionally, unless you practice and you receive all the teachings from your masters and transmit it, and then you are qualified, then only you can. So therefore, my father's inspiration, and he's always concerned me to be not as a holding a spiritual master's lineage by name as a title, but rather to make a meaningful teacher so that I can be benefit of the other beings or whoever in need. So therefore, I joined in a monastery in 1977 in Dolimji, which is a mother monastery of the Burn tradition and study then. It's in called a Menri monastery. So there I studied the 11-year course of the Burn tradition, that which includes all the teaching traditions of Dongak Semsum. Dongak Sem means Sutra, Tantra, and Dzogchen. So after that, then you graduate and you get you obtain the Geshe degree, which is the highest certificate in a spiritual tradition level of the Tibetans in general, equivalent to PhD in the West. And then you are qualified in an education or knowledge level. So then you also, as a master, then you are officially enthroned, ceremonially known as so officially recognize you as a Rinpoche or teacher to teach. So that is how I became it. And so then I was kind of prepared or qualified.
Before we go, and we're going to have to go in just a moment, I wanted to ask you more about your school. I think the last time you were here, there was a possibility for people of sponsoring a child.
Yes.
From the school. Do you
Yes.
still do that?
Yes, I still do that. And that is how mainly that I administered at the BCH, my orphanages, to support these children, because I depend totally to the support of the friends, students, and well-wishers all over. So because of that, whoever supports, kind of like $30 to $35 of the monthly support for one child is making them a living accommodation, food and clothing and education and everyday, very simple level of everyday living. So that is how I go. And they say we have an organization in Minneapolis, the Bernshen Foundation, www.bernshen.org. So through that, if you go to visit the website, there is also all categories that you call sponsorship of children or support general fund or any particular, you will get all these informations from PayPal card also we have.
And I will put that on my website.
Thank you.
Later today.
Thank you.
So the people who pay their, whatever, $30, $35 a month to support a child, do they then have a relationship with that child?
Yes. I would like to have them a relations. And a child, number one is officially we will send them a name and photos and a kind of little biography and of the children. And then time pass on, we will also sending them up-to-date reports of the annual education reports and anything special events. And children can write back and forth with their sponsor. And
so they learn English?
Oh, yes, they are. You know, from the very beginning of the school study is English. So we teach them three languages, Tibetan as our native, and then Hindi, Indian language, and the English as main. So they study all subjects that what you learn, your student here in the West.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And Geshe Latri Nima Dakpo Rinpoche will be teaching this Saturday and Sunday here in Santa Fe from 10 to 4 at the Tupten Norbuling Buddhist Center, and that is at 149 East Alameda Street here in Santa Fe. And there is a suggested donation. For more information, you can call 989-9590. That's 989-9590. And for people who go, they are encouraging free registration, so call that number. And they can park at the State Land Building across from the Desert Inn on Old Santa Fe Trail to get to this event on the weekend. We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Aaron Feuerstein. He is the retired former owner and CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Your story is a famous one, but probably not everybody's heard it. First of all, tell us the story of Malden Mills, the nature of the business, and how you learned that business.
Okay. I went into the business, almost 60 years ago. And we were in the textile business.
Your parents' ancestors?
Yes, my father and my grandfather. The corporation was founded in 1906 in Malden, Massachusetts. And my father was president, and then I came into the company. And originally they were in the sweater business, and I moved it off into the fabric business, and we made fleece. And we invented Polartec fleece, which is sold to companies like Patagonia, North Face, Lands' End, etc.
And unfortunately, I was reading you didn't patent that fleece, and so now there's a million spinoffs of fleece.
Yes, but even though we didn't patent it at that time, and perhaps it was a mistake, I don't know. And I'm no longer connected with the company. I'm retired, but I was told at the time that if you patent, since you're dealing a great deal with China, and China has very little respect for patents, that you're almost better off just keeping it secret. And we always had a policy in our company that we would only manufacture them in the United States, we wouldn't offshore, and we had to have compassion for the worker, and we had unions in our company. So we didn't patent it, but we did have a policy in addition to make the very best quality that we knew how to make, and that would be our protection.
And was it?
Yes, it was. And we not only made the best quality, but we were the only mill that I know of that actually branded the fabric so that when the consumer came into the store to buy the Patagonia jacket, he knew that the fabric in it, the Polartec fleece, was made by Malden Mills, and that was the guarantee of quality.
So in December of 1995, there was a fire, and this is what makes your story so unusual. You decided at that point not only to use the insurance money to rebuild the factory instead of moving it overseas or keeping it or whatever, but also you paid the salaries and full benefits of all the unemployed workers while the factory was being rebuilt, 3,000 employees for what, 2 or 3 months. This is very unusual in business.
Yes, very, very unusual. But interestingly, back in 1865, when the Arlington Mills in Lawrence, Mass. Started, and that's the very same premises where Malden Mills is today, they had a fire. and they actually rehired everybody and took care of everybody, and it, you know, no excitement to it, because in those days that was the value system. And today what I did went against the value system of today, unfortunately, and so that's why it received so much public recognition. So in a certain sense, maybe I don't deserve that public recognition. It's just that things are so bad today.
Well, it's funny, when you think of the mid to late 19th century value system, I think of child labor in the mills.
Yes, there maybe was child labor. I don't know. I mean, I had no connection with it in those days. But they did have a feeling that the laborer was a stakeholder and to take care of them.
I mean, you've been quoted as saying the worker is an asset rather than an expense.
He is an asset, because when I said previously that we made the best quality in the world, it was, in my opinion, only because of our good labor. And so our middle-class workers, our blue-collar laborers, they all knew that they had to make the best quality, and they did. And they gave a great deal of trust and loyalty to us, and they expected that in return, and they got it from us.
Now, your religion gave you, to some extent, or maybe a large extent, the basis for your principles in this and many other decisions that you've made as the leader of a business. Tell us how you work with Scripture and the nature of using religion in a practical way.
Okay, you know, when I try to figure out how I got these values, I think they probably were incubated when I was just a little kid. And I remember we always used to sit at our father's table. It was a great honor. We'd all sit together at dinner time in the evening. Nobody does that anymore. And my father and mother would discuss everything, and we all participated in the conversations. We talked about everything in the world. And my father one day told us at the table that a when he first went to work when he was 14 years old in his father's factory, my grandfather went around each night with a cash envelopes to pay each worker at the end of the day for the work that he did. And when my father told him, well, that's not done here in the United States, you know, you pay the following week, he said, oh, no, that's against the Bible. And the very next day when I went to have my Hebrew lessons with my maternal grandfather, I asked him, how is it possible that that's against the Bible? It doesn't seem normal. He says, oh, yes, it is. And he showed me in Leviticus where it's written that you can't oppress the worker, and that each day you have to pay him his wages, and that's what keeps him together, because he's poor and needy. And so that kind of storytelling when I was a kid, I'm sure played a big role in the value system that I have today.
We're talking to Aaron Feuerstein, and he was the owner and CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. So under what circumstances is working with the kind of principles that you're talking about, you know, non-exploitation, also good business, and under what circumstances does it go against the needs of business, namely making a profit?
Okay. Profitability is, you know, our whole economic system is based on profitability, and it's the fodder that keeps us going and it's the basis of our democracy. There's nothing wrong in profitability, and our family always was interested in profitability, but that profitability had to be done in such a way that we didn't oppress the worker. And we also considered the environment a stakeholder, and we considered the community a stakeholder. And today in business, most of the business schools teach that a 100% profitability to the shareholder is the only objective, and whatever you have to do to result in 100% profitability, you go ahead and do. And the worker is just a pair of hands. And I believe he's the worker was created in the image of God, and he's just as important as the owner of the company.
So, okay, so you have a clothing business or a fabric business, and you do it one way. Somebody else has a fabric business. They do it another way. They split the worker. They sell their fabric for a cheaper price. How do you compete?
Okay, so when we sell our fabric, it's not only on the basis of how cheap we can pay our labor, but it's on how good the fabric is. And we always made the best quality, and we were dedicated to it. And as I told you before, we actually branded our thing. We called it Politech. And that's how we competed. We made the best. And
I would think that works better in some businesses than others.
Yes. People who are in the commodity, dog-eat-dog price end of the business, would have difficulty with it. And because of that reason, I always maintain that I think that the government should set up parameters and regulations so that in the commodity business that the worker is not oppressed.
So it's interesting to hear a businessman and CEO talking about the need for government regulation.
Yes, and I'm sure it's right. You know, most of the economists today, but not all, think in terms of what Adam Smith said, that there's an invisible hand. So that you go about, all the entrepreneurs go about marketing and doing whatever they want to do with greed. But in the end, the invisible hand makes everything work out fine so that it's in the best interest of all people. I don't agree with that premise. And I think that there has to be certain parameters within which the corporation must operate. And can operate, and just taking a business and offshoring the laborers to under a dollar an hour in some foreign land like China or India is not the correct thing to do. And the end result is the laborers in that country are oppressed, and the laborers in our country lose their jobs, or they have to go make a bed somewhere, and they no longer have the benefits and the high wages and the self-dignity of being able to control a family. And the laborer hasn't got the hope of upward mobility for his children, for each generation to get better and better. And that was the hope of America. So I think that if there are certain regulations and parameters, it would be helpful without destroying our democratic principles and without destroying the world trade, the free world trade. I'm not talking against free world trade. I'm talking in favor of some reasonable regulations which would give us enough protection so that our laboring and middle class would be able to succeed in this country.
There was a tremendous reaction to what you did when you rebuilt your factory in Malden and continued to pay your workers and pay full benefits. Did you see people following in your footsteps? I mean, it led to certainly a lot of discussion about business ethics.
No, I didn't. There may be a few exceptions, but generally speaking, the average entrepreneur who is and the average CEO who's controlled by a board of directors and by the shareholder, they had no option but to run for the cheapest labor they could get. So it was almost as if the United States wanted the middle class and the laboring class to lose its position. And it's just most unfortunate.
I mean,
and if the trend isn't reversed, in my opinion, this country is looking for big, big trouble. Because what was always wonderful about this country is that the difference between the earnings of the entrepreneur and the laborer was a reasonable kind of difference. And today it's becoming more like underdeveloped countries where you have extremely rich people and the laborers are just, you know, a pair of hands.
I mean, I remember in the 90s, actually going back to the 80s, there were lots of hostile takeovers and moving people overseas, downsizing, going to places where environmental laws were weak, where labor laws were weak. Who benefited from that? I mean, was it really, as people who criticize business say, just simply an upward movement of wealth into the hands of the few?
That's, I think, what it was. It was the few, the intelligent, creative, marketing entrepreneur was the one that got the benefit, and the working class and the middle class lost out. And we have to figure out how to redistribute it and do it differently. I have some great ideas.
Let's hear them.
They're my own ideas, and I don't know if they would succeed. But in any event, everyone has to come up with ideas of how we can, how to innovate and how to do it so that our great country can continue to succeed.
The ideas
that I have are, one, that just like here in this country, all our laborers have a minimum wage, and there are certain benefits and certain government protections over the environment, over the health, over the safety, etc., etc. That same thing has to exist in the foreign country that's trying to export into the United States. They can operate whatever way they want in their own country, but if they're going to export into the United States, those products, just like the food, has to come in, it has to pass certain regulations. And so there's the minimum wage and time and a half, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't have to be exactly the same as what's in the United States, but it should be within their currency and what they consider poverty. And I think that can be done. And in that way, even though there still would be some outsourcing and some offshoring, it wouldn't go on at the pace that what's going on here in our country today. And I have another great idea.
Let's hear it.
And that is patent protection. We all accept in our country that the innovator and the one who applies for the patent, the entrepreneur, he's protected from the capitalistic competition because he had the idea. And he goes to the patent office and protected for 20 years. But the very next day, he can make the product with labor from outside the United States instead of labor inside the United States. So if he were required, if he gets a patent in the United States, and that's where he wants it because that's where he'll get the protection. If he wants to get the 20 years, he has to extend that 20 years to his laborers and his middle class. So in that way, the United States would be making the newest product and only losing the oldest kind of product to the world free trade.
That's a great idea.
Thank you.
Well, we're running out of time. What brings you to Santa Fe?
I love Santa Fe. It's a fabulous place. I was at a conference. I was invited to speak at a conference here of business and consciousness. And I told my wife, I have an opportunity to go to Santa Fe, which we both love. And that's why we're here. And instead of staying just for the 3 days of the conference, we stayed a whole week. And it's just splendid.
And so this business and consciousness, what kind of a conference was it? What were people talking about?
They were talking about how to be more humane one to the other and social responsibility. So I was sort of related to that. And so they asked me to talk.
So whatever happened to Malden Mills? Where is it today?
Malden Mills is still operating, one of the few textile companies operating in the United States, but it's no longer under my control, and I'm retired from it, and I don't speak for Malden Mills today.
But unfortunately, they continue to make Polar Tech. And
yes, they do.
So I want to thank you so much for being here, Aaron Feuerstein, and he's the former owner, CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for being here on the Radio Cafe.
Well, I want to thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the Amadeus Suite by British composer, arranger, and trumpet player Guy Barker. And on Sunday, on KSFR at 4 p.m., the KSFR Forum, moderated by John Greenspan, features William Stewart, Asenath Kepler, and Greg Bemis discussing the new short-term rental law and the government's plan to save the economy. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, as he is every Friday, speaking of the arts. And we'll also be joined by Pasatiempo writer Craig Smith, and we're going to be talking about the nature of criticism and writing about the arts and stuff like that. So all that and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.